Subject matter for tonight, two requests. One, transcendence. The other, cosmic origin of sexuality. Which would you rather have? Gentlemen cry, transcendence. Ladies cry, imminence. Maybe they'll fit together if we're lucky. We'll start with absolute transcendence and get rid of it very quickly. Transcendence, going beyond anything whatever. Suppose we go beyond all manifestation whatever, beyond the universe of phenomena, beyond all appearances, beyond finitude, into the infinite before the beginning of creation. What do we have there? I should call upon Greta to define it for me. The void. And the void must mean potential form, because the universe exists. So somehow the transcendence has given rise to existence. Those of you who have read Lao Tzu's Tao will remember that before the existent is a non-existent. That is the absolute transcendence. And then the existent is the mother of all things, the mother. That might suggest that the transcendence is the father. Well, having got rid of transcendence that quickly, we'll go on to consider something we can talk about a little longer. Imagine that everything that we know is factually energy. The forms of energy, when they rotate, are interpreted from outside the rotation as resistant matter of some degree, subtle, like ideas, or gross, like so-called physical bodies. Now, if it weren't for energy, there would be no work. If it weren't for work, there would be no universe of phenomena. So somehow, the transcendent has a capacity for work. When it doesn't use it, there is no manifestation. When it does use it, manifestation begins or continues. Let us imagine infinite sentient power. Remember, because we are not dualists and cannot be so logically, sentience and power must somehow be two different sides of the same coin. Sentience refers to the fact that we feel that we exist. We have a sense of existence. And power refers to that we can push things about a bit. Sentience without power would be an awareness of nothing. Power without sentience would be pushing with no knowledge of the push. So somehow, sentience and power, SP, are inseparable. Let's put them together as SP and derive the S and the P from an A, which we put in the middle, making SAP. We'll say A symbolizes the absolute, and its first polarization is into sentience and power. That is, it can push around within itself. It is power, and the power pushes itself, and it can be aware of its own pushing and the effects of it. We will say that that SAP, SAP, in sapience, is a word that means, fundamentally, wisdom. Wisdom like a snake. Now, I'll do a little drawing if this thing and kindly oblige to show. Imagine power going along in a uniform manner like this. Let that represent three streams of power traveling at the same rate in a uniform manner, no acceleration, no deceleration. I again turn to Goethe and say, what is the self-experience of a field of power which is moving uniformly, no acceleration, no deceleration? It has nothing to feel against. If we were to fill the rest of the space here available with lines in this manner, make all the lines uniform, all in the same direction, all at the same speed, the result of that would be as if nothing had been done at all, because of the uniformity, which would not allow any differential awareness. Now, power is also sentient. It feels its state. But if it's moving uniformly, what it feels is uniform motion. Uniform motion will not give it any differential, and therefore it might as well not be. So the same power, if it desires to become self-aware in a differential or discriminate manner, it must either accelerate or decelerate or bend in some way. One of the most obvious ways of bending is a waveform. Now again, when we see this waveform, and remember that it represents a movement of sentient power, we can see that in the one side, there, it is apparently negative. That is to say, it's concave. And on the other side, it is positive. It is swelling. Now, if we take a piece of wire to represent this line and proceed to bend the wire backwards and forwards, what is the first thing we quickly observe about the wire? The temperature is going up. In bending it, we have introduced a differential at the place of bend. That means when the wave goes down, there's a pushing on the one side and a relative vacuity on the other. And as it goes along, it changes phase. The negative becomes positive. The negative becomes positive. Now imagine sentient power in the waveform has discovered a way of enjoying itself by simply bending. Now that is the origin of the symbol of the serpent as sensuality. Sensuality consists in a search for heightened self-awareness, heightened pleasure in being. Now if that is one way, maybe another can exist. So this sentient power, this serpentine proposition, self-positing, SP, can do this. Without stopping its continuous movement, it can introduce into itself zones of arcing. I'll put arc there with a K. All the way along, wherever there is a rotation, there is an arc. Now the arc there, in its fullness, is a circle. Not simply a little piece of the circle, but the whole circle. The energy streams along, and then rotates, and then goes in the opposite side, goes along, rotates again. When it does so, again, it heightens its awareness. But there is a possible danger for it. It can, when it goes like this, instead of going out to a fresh experience, it can go round and keep going round and become repetitive. Now, in the loop form, loop as in move, you have a situation where the sentient power going along has improved on the original polarization of flexing and bending, and introduced the concept of arcing and the creation of a zone of heightened awareness because of increased self-resistance. All is still well. But the moment we make a closed circle and forget to go out of it, we become repetitive. And it's at that point where we say the fall has occurred. Now remember that the sentient power is infinite, and is all that is. It is to explain everything we know. Sentience is the awareness. Power is the positor of the object of the awareness. Anywhere, whatever, we can draw this closed system. It doesn't have to be related to another closed system. Infinity anywhere can do that. Number six has always been, since numeration was used symbolically, as the number of existence. In fact, existence derives from the same word that we derive six from, existere, out of a sixness. It means the energy from the infinite goes and turns, and that creates in the turn a fall into the principle of turn. And the principle of turn, we can say tour, a door, plus n, which means continuity, continuous turning, continuous door making. Here is a door. You go in to the door and you don't come out, and you repeat your performance, possibly forever. It is possible to conceive that a sentient power might lock itself in to a situation so tightly that it would forget that it had ever been out, and it would consider itself to be a separate being. And then something else arises. If we have the power by six to produce a zone of finitude, we have the power to produce a zone of contingent stimulation, where the two strike each other. And this is what happens in the four. A situation that before the closure was free and the power was going along and gaining its sensuous enjoyment by its free oscillation, by its turning through and out and on, now becomes a situation where one being can stimulate and cloud another. We call that contingent or with touch relationship. When you tap yourself like that, you are demonstrating contingent stimulation to yourself. Now, if you then focus on the contingent stimulus point and forget that you are self-precipitated, you have fallen from the highest freedom into the lowest type of bondage, slavery to an external stimulus. And most people suffer very largely from what they call the need to be noticed, the need to be affirmed, the need to be recognized, the need to be given a place amongst society and other beings. Well, this need is a contingency. And as long as there is a need for any being to need a stimulus from without, a stimulus of the contingent order, that being is in total slavery to the external situation and has forgotten his original transcendence. Now, it is this identification in the six, even the forgetting of the tail of the six, so in its extreme form, we simply have the circle. Anciently, that would be symbolized as a serpent with its tail in its mouth. a self-stimulating, self-perpetuating, eternal pursuit of something, where nothing is but self, locked in the belief that it has to be stimulated in order to know. It bites its own tail, the stimulus on the tail goes out, along from the tail point, along the body to the head, and says, I have been stimulated. And the head says, bite back. So that another stimulus goes round. And this serpent, this sensuous cycle of self-stimulation, is what is meant by hell. In all the great religions, hell means a bondage caused by self-stimulation of a closed system. Now, let's look at the original concept of the polarity in another way. Imagine a stream of energy uniformly going along in that manner, thinking, here is another way of self-stimulation. I will go so far and then I will turn in like this and travel along, making a vector within. Now you see from this simple diagram, it is possible for an energy to move along, fold in and move back, so that the original movement, on the appearance of the retrograde movement, becomes like a tube surrounding an inner force travelling in the opposite direction. Now that movement of power gives you an interesting thing. I'll put it more in 3D. This is a perspective. A tube of power that closes on itself, turns back, goes in the opposite direction, and continuously does this in both directions. And what happens here is exactly the same as that mode of function that generates lightning. The movement of the one field of sentient power inside the other charges, that is to say, wakes it up, stimulates it, and makes it more and more intense. The more that movement goes in contrary directions, like this, the more energy goes into it. If we then turn the whole diagram over and take it so far and then back again, so we take the energy from there and turn it back like this, we now have a drawing of the pre-fall divine hermaphrodite. Remember, it is sentient power. It is capable of making a tube of itself, which is a vestment, folding up, going inside, going to the other end, and then travelling the other way. And in so doing, it is drawing energy from infinity and creating around it a great aura of interest. Now, if we like to simplify this diagram further, we can say, here is the force that goes in, and here is the force that generated it, in this manner. That is exactly the same diagram, simplified. And then later on, the recipient one will become, by progressive intensification, will become a womb in a living being on earth. There is no difference in the process of the generation of polarity by this method. The creation of lightning in the sky, the sudden release of power generated by this double motion, and the ejaculation in a sexual encounter. Now we have to find out, of what use is this double motion? What does it do that cannot occur any other way? Now, you remember your elementary biology. Single cell, a marine creature, can reproduce itself non-sexually, that is, without manifest sexual organ differentiation, it can turn inside itself and make smaller turns, and then it can open and flip them out, like that. And it can propagate its kind in this manner. And we observe under the microscope that when beings are reproduced in this manner of self-reproduction, they are all identical with the original. There is no appearance of a unique character. There's no added interest. So then, if we return to our other diagram, we see a method whereby we can create a difference. You know, in vegetative reproduction, you can get a potato, cut it to pieces with eyes in, plant it, and get the same potato. But if you wait till it goes to seed and then plant the seeds, then the forms are different. Differentiation occurs through a cross-fertilization process. Now, the experience of the tube with itself, that is one experience, and it is demanding a filler for its voidity, and the filler is another experience. Remember, the power is centered, and it always feels exactly what it is doing. It is self-aware of its own mode of activity. In the process, it can do any kind of diverse operation within this dual relationship, and in the process, avoid mere repetition instead of the round-goingness of a simple marine creature monocell flipping out other roundnesses identical. By this process of self-opposition, the division into two different kinds, one of them a receiver, the other a giver, and the non-correspondence, the non-uniformity of their mode of action, differential stimuli arise. Now, the most amazing thing about this sentient power, which is at the back of all evolutionary theory, is its capacity to capitalize on anything whatever that happens. So if we imagine, two lovers who are totally in agreement. So if they want to go to the theatre to see a play, they want to go to see the same play in the same theatre at the same time. Now, such creatures are very rare. A condition approximating to that might last about 5 minutes, but after a few hours, differences arise simply because the will of the Absolute towards S and P is insisting that the relationship shall not fall into a uniform condition. Uniformity is equivalent to voidity. Women are more sensitive to this than men. So women are always reminding men there's a thing called relationship. Now, men don't know about relationship with ladies. Women know about relationship with men. Men know about relationships with scientific projects that they have in mind. They don't tend to relate back to the woman that's relating to them. Now, there's a very good reason for this, which comes under the heading of the raising of Cain. The division is, there shall be a receptacle which has evolved into the form in the human level of woman, and there shall be a Cain raiser in the form of man. Now, Cain represents intellectual formative power, and it is the function of the man to find something different. It is the function of the feminine pole to receive that difference and then to feed it, consolidate it, and release it into the world. Now here is the absolute ground of all the debates that have ever occurred between men and women since they first appeared on earth. But we have to remember that the gross physical body contains in its economy an emotional body, finer energy, a mentational body, a conceptual body, and a volitional body within the field of consciousness. When we start permutating the number of constituents of our being and allow them a polarization of receptivity and donational power, we come into an untellable number of differential possibilities. Let's consider this very carefully. The uniform motion of a pair of beings would mean the non-awareness of those beings to each other. Uniformity gives no power of differentiation. And if there is no differentiation, there is a falling to sleep. In physics, that's called entropy. In Hindu philosophy, it's pralaya. A flattening effect. When things collide with each other repeatedly, they slow each other down each time because each one absorbs some of the energy of the other one in the collision. So finally the energies are passed from one to the other both ways until they're both equally energized, and that equal energization is equivalent to flatness, to non-being. Unless you have a differential, you cannot be aware that you exist. So this primordial movement in contrary directions and the generation out of a non-dual power, the absolute, into two aspects, one of sentience, one of power, the generation of the relation between sentience and power through its myriad permutations produces all the universe that we know. Now what use is this to us? Well, it means if we want to do what is called living, why one wants to live is a problem. But if one does, then the only way to become consciously aware of livingness and to heighten it is to produce differential stimuli. You must not say the same thing in the same way continuously. Some of you may remember the little sketch of the man that always went to the door in the morning to go to work with his wife on his heels and held his cheek up to be kissed. 8 o'clock in the morning, every morning except the seventh day. And then his mother-in-law became ill and his wife went away to see her, and still at 8 o'clock in the morning he went to the door and held his cheek up to be kissed. That meant to say the behavior pattern, the rotation in the nervous system had established itself. He was now unconscious of what he was doing. Therefore, there was no value whatever in that goodbye, darling, every morning kiss. It's gone. And that is a dreadful warning. Somehow, the process called waking up, and all the major religions say, wake up. The great Zen meditations are to do, wake up. The meditations of Jesus. Wake up, be quick, be alert. Do not fall into uniform stimulation of your environment. Because if you do, you will cease to exist. You will not stand out. Anybody who is uniform in their stimulation of the environment, like Immanuel Kant, going for a walk every day at the same time, becomes a thing. That's a vital living proposition. Now, in the fallen state of man, there is progressive forgetfulness of higher levels. So that one time, deliberate production of a non-uniform stimulus lapsed and then fell into behavioral cycles with continuous loss of consciousness. Now, at the lowest level, called the gross material level, which is the level of our bones, particularly the bones of a corpse, at that level, there is only knocking on each other. And the being that requires from another being a knock to wake it up is a slave to the stimulus. If no stimulus comes, it feels as if it is dying. It feels neglected. It feels not wanted. It's quite sure that it's not wanted. And then it begins to accuse itself of being worthy of being not wanted. Now, many people experience a phase of self-accusation when they stand in front of the mirror and say, "What is the matter with me? Nobody likes me. Nobody invites me to parties. Nobody gives me presents. Nobody remembers my birthday." And when a person is quite convinced that no one else is thinking about him or her, when they're quite convinced, they die. That is to say, the energy which would be provided by the stimulus doesn't come. Now, you know that if you warm a body and the environment around that body is cooler than the body radiates its heat into the environment. Now, imagine a void with a hot body in it. The hot body will lose its heat, and the heat will vanish into the void, and it will be no more. It will become non-existent. Now, you remember your elementary physics. Heat is work, and work is heat. If you lose heat, you cease to work. The less heat you have, most of our heat is derived from food, which comes from the sun. But if you lose that energy, you diminish in size. Just like the astronomers say the sun is losing photons, millions of tons per minute, and is getting smaller and smaller, and sometime in the far distant future, it will be out. It will undergo what is called a heat death. There will be no more sun. And if we were still on Earth at that time, we would all perish through lack of energy input. So imagine that unless you can give a non-uniform stimulus into your environment, then the environment will forget that you exist. And your energy will then go out looking for a return from the environment. And in the process, you will diminish in size and effectiveness and become like nothing at all. And the nothing you will reach will be a negative phase of the original nothing, which was the transcendence that started the whole process in the first place. So this nothingness can be viewed in two different ways. Now, the word means not a thing. So the word nothing is not quite what most people think about. Nothing means not a thing, not a finite. A thing is a power crucified on itself and inwardly condensed on itself, so that it does not give out, and it is condensed more and more on the center of its own being. So that any power moving outside can treat it as a non-responsive thing to be kicked about. That is the negative aspect of a no-thing, is precisely that it has given no stimulus to the environment. Its uniformity is the same as its non-existence. Now, the positive aspect, which is pursued by all the mystics and all the yogis, is to come to the same state of nothingness, but not negatively. That is, deliberately pursue it. Now, supposing we imagine the universe is full of beings, and on Earth we know it, we see them, lots and lots of beings, and we know that they're in their fallen state, they have identified with the physical body, and we know, therefore, that they are requiring stimulation from outside their bodies knocking to wake them up. And if they don't get their knocking, they begin to diminish. Now supposing, therefore, you deliberately say, inside my skin there are as many beings as there are outside it. We call this the macrocosmic correspondence. The little universe, the microcosm, and the big universe, the macrocosm, are the same. Their content is identical. And inside us we have portions of ourselves seeking expression by knocking on other portions of ourselves to try to wake us up. And we have three main divisions. We feel, and we move, and we think. In this order, first we feel, and then the feeling is the need for a stimulus. We move to seek it, and then we encounter a resistance, and the resistance provokes us to think how to overcome it. So if we draw three circles, the head, the chest, and the tummy, we number the chest one, the tummy one, two, and the head one, three. Starts in the feeling, in the heart state, moves down into the drive or conation. That encounters an obstacle or opposition or even pain, and the energy flies back into the head to think how to overcome the opposition. If we know this, we can then stimulate our thought, our feeling, and our will within ourselves. And this is a kind of internal sexual relation. We polarize ourselves into drive, pursuit of sensuous delight, reason telling us to be careful because the pursuit of sensual delights results in troubles. And these two are polarizations of the primordial feeling in the heart. Now, if we feed an idea into the tum that is utterly irrelevant to the purpose of the tum remains asleep. But if we feed an idea into the tum related either to food or sexuality, it wakes up. If we feed an idea into the heart, that is the center of compassion. If we feed the idea of compassion into the head will find reasons for us to justify the compassion. But if we feed the idea of compassion into the tummy, it will find some very good non-reasons to disregard it if it contradicts its own search for pleasure. Now, by this internal process of internal self-feeding of the poles of being, comes heightened awareness. Instead of waiting for an external being to feed an idea into us, or to be emotional in our presence, or to attack us sexually, instead of waiting for that, and it may not come, we meditate on the kind of response that we would give to any of those energy inputs. And this process of meditation consists in feeding from one part of the being a characteristic stimulus into another part with another characteristic. Now, in yoga philosophy, you talk about chakras or lotuses, which we call nerve plexi in the West, in which there are seven foci in the body up the spine, and the three lower ones are called baddies. They're naughty. The lowest one is a survival intent, pure survival. Everything is to be done for survival. If you are to survive, you may have to kill another being. It doesn't matter. The imperative is survive. You are a predator, they are prey. And although it can't think in the ideational sense that the head can think, it can and does have a process of self-justification in the instinct to survive. Now, immediately above the survival chakra or lotus, you have another one, sexual enjoyment. Now, that one is almost trying to procreate. out of generosity. It wishes to reproduce itself, and like that little marine creature, condensing in itself, and then throwing out reproductions of itself. So that that second level chakra is what we call the sexual center, aiming at reproduction of itself. In the process, it has encountered other beings and found if it has a male stress in itself, it needs a receptacle to receive its offering of self-reproduction. If it's a female, it goes around looking for something to receive. Now the third center above that is the will to power expression. You're not concerned with mere survival or with mere reproduction. You're concerned with being a proper top cat or a top dog, according to whether you're a woman or a man. But power demonstration is the third level. Now the fourth level is in the heart, and that chakra is centered in the whole being, and because the heart is the center of the circulation and the blood feeds all, that center is aware that the survival and reproduction and demonstration of power requires the feeding of all the being. So the heart is the natural center for compassion. It has feeling for its own toes, feeling for its ears, feeling for its hair, feeling for its teeth. If you feel very carefully, without touching the end of your nose with your finger like this, you can actually feel that you have a nose, can't you? Do you ever think that the word feeling has two exactly opposite meanings? In which, in the lowest sense, it means touching like this. And in the other sense, it means not touching, but sentient power, self-aware. So in the heart, which is the center of the circulation, is the awareness that this whole organism must be fed with the elements in the blood and with the oxygen to keep the whole being functioning for the benefit of the whole. And that is called the center of compassion. Now above the center of compassion, you have three goodies. One is the larynx center, where you are aware of the capacity for articulate expression. Another is between your eyebrows, where you're aware that you can command things, and they shall be, let it be, and it is. And on the top of your head, you have another lotus said to be 1,000 petals, which simply means a very large number, because it includes everything there is. Now the three lower ones are survival, reproduction through sexual relation, and power demonstration. They're the three baddies. And the three upper ones are true speech, firm command based on the truth, and awareness of the absolute on the top of your head. The middle one, number four, is the heart center. And it's in that center that everything is to be coordinated. If, in a process of meditation, you were to think very carefully, very accurately, like a true Aquarian, and you were to have the survival intent and the will to reproduce, and the capacity for speech, and you were aware that the universe is infinite, and you had six of these, but not the seventh, namely compassion, your meditation is self-destructive. Because when you feed energy into a part of your being, that part grows, and in the process becomes independent. This is the ground of schizophrenia. If you feed any part of your being without having compassion, that is awareness of all the parts of the being, you feed, isolate, make tumescent, make aggressive that part of the being on which you concentrate. Now we have to see that that primordial division of a power moving through itself in contrary directions at the level of macrocosmos, the very first creation of a sphere to provide the resistance for the infinite absolute to push through, is exactly reproduced in the human economy. Then you have to say to yourself, I am going to learn to do exactly in my skin what the universe outside does inside the big universal skin. You have planets going around the sun. You have forces going around the body in the same way. You have phasicity in the moon and other planets. You have phasicity in your mind. And you have the apparent motion of the sun through the wheel of the zodiac. And you have a motion inside your body of the will, which is going about inside your body and doing things with all the different parts of the body. Now you remember, we have four horizontals and one vertical. The physical body, the emotive body, the mentational body, the conceptual body. They're all passive. The will is not. And the justice of thumb can oppose each finger at will, or they can be bunched and opposed together. So all the organs of the body can be focused upon by the will. Now you know that blood circulation follows in the body innervation. Where the nerve impulses go, there the blood goes. But where the interest goes, there goes the nervous impulse. And the interest goes where your will indicates as worthy of research. So within the physical economy, there is an emotional economy, and a mentational one, and a conceptual one. And these are ruled by the will in the reflexive being. But in a being that has fallen into external contingency, needing something from other beings, it doesn't use the will. It reacts mechanically, and so is enslaved and determined in its behavior by the characteristics of the stimuli that come to it. Now this fallen state is the state that when experienced at its worst level, which is called the dark night of the soul, a total misery and the belief that this being has no value. This being would be better non-existent. This being has been deserted by God, if there is a God. This very, very worst state is the state from which, historically, has arisen the desire for transcendence. Transcendence of that state of fallenness. We will see that it is not transcendence of the infinite absolute state, but rather the opposite. Instead of going beyond, the absolute creative power went inwards and posited the individual as a doorway through which to push and feel the resistance of the door frame in passing through. Now you know, if you force a fluid through a tube and then narrow the tube, where it goes narrow, it accelerates. That's the same thing as saying, where you get pinched by the environment, your consciousness heightens. Now there's been an awful lot of waste of thinking by people in a negative state who have written books about transcendence in this negative state and recommended getting out of existence. The Buddhistic psychology itself is the supreme example of this, where it says, let us start off with the proposition, all existence is suffering, and then logically work to get out of it. And discover the way to get out of suffering is simply give up the desire to exist and become a new thing. Mrs. Ruth Davis did not believe that this was the original teaching of Gautama Buddha. She said, a man that could have such an effect on people must have had a lot of energy. He could not at all escapism. And yet, funnily enough, most of the Buddhist scriptures, nevertheless, teach that kind of escapism into the condition of nirvana. Absolute bliss beyond existence, where the self-consciousness vanishes into infinity and there is no more problem. Now, Mrs. Rich David's statement about it is ignored. She said he couldn't have told her. They say he did. She said no, it was later disciples who taught that, 300 years later, or even more, and that no records of his actual statements were made at the time he was teaching, but most of them come from 3 centuries later. And by the natural law of human distortion, she said, you can't expect to get the truth out of people who went hiding in monasteries. Now, which one is right? We cannot historically determine. What we do know is that there was another man, a Jewish fellow, who came from Nazareth, who taught loudly, firmly the opposite. He said, you can't get rid of yourself. He said, take up your position, the one you're in daily, call it crucifixion, affirm it, and then penetrate through the resistance, don't back out of it, and get the message of the characteristics of the resistance by pushing through it. In other words, do not avoid the devil. Go out into the desert, that is into isolation, and test yourself for your reflexes, and then come back into society and give them the results. Now, he's therefore called the first historical true individual, because instead of saying, let us vanish into the infinite bliss, he said, let us appear in time and stand out, and this word exists, stand out, speak, be upstanding and be counted, and make your view known, and this will enrich total universal sentient power and justify your individual existence. These two apparently opposite religions are reduced to another kind of religion by certain groups who say, let's call it esoteric Buddhism equals esoteric Christianity. And let us recognize that the men that took the teaching into India in the first place came out of the same area that Abraham came out of. And that the Brahmins in India and the Abrahamins of the Jewish faith were really the same people who dispersed this idea throughout the world. And then say you can do both at once. You can transcend your situation by the technique called non-identification, breaking of identification, detachment. Vairagya means to see the whole troublesome game, and then instead of letting go of the deed, continue the deed but let go of the identification. Now, this is the message condensed of the Bhagavad Gita. Act without regard to the fruit of the action, do not identify with it, but don't stop acting. The action keeps power moving through power. And the power moving through itself in contrary directions heightens the awareness and presents ever new problems, and by the non-coordination of viewpoints arises myriads and myriads of new viewpoints, so that there is a permanent and eternal enrichment of universal sentient power, not through agreement, but through disagreement. But a disagreement in which you disagree deliberately. You agree to differ, and you differ in order to agree about the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is infinite enrichment of universal sentient power. The way to it is differential presentation. Viewpoints that are not harmonized, not made identical. Now, you know perfectly well, in your own experience, that if you try to agree with somebody else within society, you are always suppressing something. You are not giving your true opinion. You are afraid of treading on someone's toes, contradicting their viewpoint, and possibly gaining an enemy. And society, since the fall, has been built on this peculiar mode of behavior we call policy, politeness. Let's consider this very carefully. When you meet any person at all, and you get into conversation, you're presumably trying to enrich your life by an exchange of views. But ordinarily, when you talk, you put questions to them, and if you see certain looks of disapproval on the face, you remove the question. If you see a look of pleasure at something you've said, which might be accidental or naive or stupid, as soon as you see the look of recognition and delight, you say it again. This means that in civilization, most people are lying all the time to each other to produce a condition of social calm. If they all go into uniform agreement, they'll all fall asleep. So you need the competitive spirit reintroducing into the body of the people. Now, dialectic means that in every word employed, there is the opposite significance to the face one. If you say transcendence, immanence is implied. Because why does an egoic structure, an individual, wish to transcend? The answer is, it is in trouble. Why does it want to get out of trouble? Because it's painful. If it gets out of all pains and all troubles, it falls into uniformity, maximum entropy, and ceases to be an individual. Now the funny thing is that most of the schools of yoga today in the world have been formed by men who have promised egoic powers transcending that of ordinary people. You can pay $4,000 to learn how to levitate. You can do all kinds of wonderful things, and these things are to make the ego stand out over all others. And the more people join, the less possibility there is of those people becoming what they wish to be. Now the appeal is always to the finitely identified, weakened, and approaching impotence condition of the empirical egoic structure. The ego wishes to retain itself, to be what it is, to remember its own name, its own origin, its own heraldry, to write a book about it. And at the same time, it wishes to become infinitely transcendent. But to be infinitely transcendent is not to be an ego at all. And this is what we mean by a dialectical process. Whatever is done contains in itself the opposite. And if you push it, it will start to go the opposite way. And this is like our original diagram. The energy is going along, folding on itself, that makes the ego structure, and pushes back through the pre-egoic field. When it does so, it becomes very aware that it is increasing power, building up for the big lightning flash, and in that moment of increasing power, it always gets the idea, I can make a big bang that will shock everyone into noticing me. But the moment of the big bang is the explosion of the egoic structure that has the ambition to make the big bang. At the moment of that explosion, it doesn't exist. Now those few of you that have actually got married and had sexual relation and experienced orgasm know that at that moment, the orgasmic moment, at that moment you don't exist. If you've ever tried to retain awareness in the sexual relation at the orgasmic moment, if you tried to retain perfect self-centeredness without diversion from the orgasmic process, you have failed. At the moment of targeting to reach that point of explosion, you cease to exist. So who is getting the benefit? not the egoic structure. But the universe itself is being enriched. The universe is laughing every time it sees anybody crying. Now that's a dialectical process. The tears of the people attend to their life and water it and it grows. And their prayers ascend to God, and God looks upon them and says, very nicely composed hymn that was. Now to get that hymn, like John Bunyan, you have to go to jail. So every time you get in a situation that squeezes you, and you produce a poem, or a song, or a new Andrew Lloyd Webber work or something, every time you do that, God is smiling because your shoes are pinching. And there is no other way of creating. Creation requires suffering. Creation heightened requires heightened suffering. Now there are two ways of suffering. One is miserably, as when somebody else imposes on you the suffering and you think, I don't like it because I didn't invent it. Suffering imposed on you, which you take passively, is no good. It's of no benefit to you whatever. But deliberate suffering, where you choose for yourself a difficulty and push yourself into a difficult situation and insist on pushing through it to the end, that causes enlightenment. That causes enrichment of the universe. Now imagine a man who knows this, and there is a special type of process called the way of the left-hand magician. It consists of doing all the naughties very vigorously, but very consciously. And it causes everybody to get very, very excited, and then they all throw energies out in their despair or their fury, and the energies go out into the universe, and the universe is stirred up very much, and wonderful patterns appear in the cosmic mind, and the cosmic mind is very glad to see them. And the people who are able to do that are counted as naughties by the fallen people, but they're counted as very useful fellows by God, because they stir everybody up. Now imagine a situation. You have centers in your body dedicated to certain functions. In the spine, nerves come through at certain levels, and they are connected to certain organs, and each organ is dedicated to a certain kind of function. And each function is selfish. And the more it is used, the more isolated from the others it becomes, the more selfish it becomes. So if you take any one of them and feed it to the exclusion of the others, then you will actually begin to disintegrate, to fall apart. And we've said that only number four, that is compassion in the heart, saves the other six. The three goodies are baddies unless they're fed by compassion. And the three baddies are baddies unless fed by compassion. Just as the will to mere survival can produce predatorial, murderous intent, and the intent to reproduce one's kind can result in head bashing by goats and things, and the intent to exercise power, those three most obviously are baddies. Just in the same way, the top three are baddies if they have no compassion. The ability to talk, the larynx center, the ability to give orders between the eyebrows, and the awareness of an absolute transcendence on the top of your head. It's very good to know there is absolute transcendence. It's very good to be in a position of being able to give commands which are obeyed. God said, let there be, and it was. And it's very good to be articulate to know what you're talking about. But if those three goodies are divorced from the heart-centered compassion, they're no good at all. Only that fourth position on the heart harmonizes them all and makes them work together. Remember the macrocosm-microcosm correspondence. Whatever there is in the universe, stars, solar system, planets, all these things are inside our skin. And the same law applies within as without. As within, so without. As above, so below. So we can study astronomy and then apply the rules of astronomy inside our physical body. And we can study the principles of psychology and apply them in the external world. We can apply any rule that we learn within or without to the opposite from where we derive it. Because the inside was precipitated from the out, and the outside precipitated the in. How do we feel if we think to ourselves? What we have ignorantly thought of as sexuality at the contingent level was the most inefficient of all sexual relations. The idea that you have to knock over your opponent with a fist and then take the body, called the lust of the body, and treat the body as a contingent stimulating device. You can buy them in PVC. Any living being that is treated as if it were a thing of contingency only hates the user. We should say the misuser. Now, you'll observe that if we add compassion to any of the others, we immediately lift the profane into the sacred. Now, profane is said to mean, and this is a blind, and before the temple, profanum. But that fan means straw. And straw symbolized in the ancient world the common people. So to behave profanely meant to behave like common people behave. Now how do they behave? They behave with total lack of consideration, total lack of compassion for each other in the survival situation, and in the sexual situation, and in the power demonstration situation. Now, the higher you go up the social scale educationally, the more consciousness there is, the more consideration there is, and the more there is an approximation to the condition of at least the idea of compassion. But the idea of compassion is not compassion. An idea of compassion can exist in the head. You can have an idea that compassion is a good thing, that it helps interfunction, that it makes things work better. But the idea of itself is not the compassion. And a lot of people think it does. They think if they have an idea of being helpful, they are helpful. But if their idea of helpfulness remains an idea, even if they were to donate to charities various things, and the charities got the benefit and did various things, if the giver had only an idea of compassion, he personally would not get the benefit of the compassion, because he would be feeding the idea center and not the heart center. And remember, only the heart center supplies the blood for the whole being. The idea center doesn't. The idea supplies form. Idea means form. It allows you to count, to evaluate, to formally correct things, but it doesn't do anything but formally change things. And the word, which is articulate and can talk very nicely about things, if that is divorced from compassion, you can actually talk or write poems about compassion, and you can recite them, and you can do them as well as Dylan Thomas. But it doesn't mean that you have the internal condition of compassion and the feeding of the whole being in that way. And so with the others, with the will to power, if you have compassion, you don't over-exercise it. You don't not use it if you've got it. You might need power to lift somebody out of the canal. But if at the moment of lifting the child out of the canal, you are thinking about your muscles and not the life of the child, you don't get the benefit. The same with the reproduction. Now, the major problems for the human race at our present state of evolution consist of two. One is envy, which sees anything superior in any way as to be decried because it is not possessed by the envier, and to be able to take a joy in the good fortune of another being, a genuine felt joy from the heart, a compassionate joy in the good fortune of another being, is nearly an unknown quality in the human race. So, in order to develop wholeness, one has to learn, one has to practice actually taking joy in somebody else winning the pool, somebody else receiving a large legacy, to be able to be delighted with somebody else's good fortune is the great problem. And the other one is sexuality. What is called of the seven deadly concupiscence is the enjoying of another's body without regard to the other person's enjoyment in the relation. That is to use the body of a being in a sexual way without any regard whatever for the effect upon the psyche of the body being used. That's called concupiscence. Now the opposite of that is supreme compassion within the sexual relation for the partner, so that the partner's needs, the partner's joy in the relation takes first place, and at no point does it ever fall into the partner being used as a means of external frictive self-stimulation. 2 points: envy of all the goods of the world and compassion within the sexual situation. Those are the two rarest things on earth today. Is that not true? Do we spontaneously have the ability to take great joy if somebody else starts something good? Or do we think, I could have started that if I had thought of it? It's true. This is a universal in the human race at this stage of evolution. Somebody paints a picture, somebody writes a poem, and you know damn well you could have written that yourself. It's like all the books you see on the shelves in the shops. You pick one out and say, good God, it's rubbish, you know that. And you say, I could have written that myself, if I had thought of writing it. It's so bad, I could have written it myself and got the money. And this poor fellow who's written that rotten book, which I could have written, has got the money. And you don't feel terribly happy about him. That's tremendously important. Envy and concupiscence. The using of another living being as a mere body of frictive operation. Those are our two biggest enemies today. We've degenerated from the original situation long ago, which is called the Golden Age, an age of spontaneous compassion. Vaguely you can see it today in some animals, some birds, sort of mutual compassion. But there's not much of it even in the animal world, because the human being has not only corrupted himself and the race, he's also helped largely to corrupt other life forms. Now, transcendence means going beyond, and the situation for an egoic being trapped in the negative results of his own activity is to want to transcend it, get out of it. And if he wants to get out of the trouble, only the trouble, not the implications. And if you transcend absolutely, you're back in the infinite absolute. In the infinite absolute, you're in the condition before creation. You are simply an infinite sentient power, uniform, and as if you were non-existent. Therefore, in that absolute state, there arises a will to create. And there you are back again in the situation as an individuated being that you wanted to get out of. So you have to see this transcendence from both ends. Transcend the egotism, and then transcend the transcendence and come back into individual existence. Now we have this two-fold problem for us, more than any other problem. Envy and utilization for sexual purposes of another being are not centered in the compassionate heart. If we don't work on that compassion, no matter what else we may acquire, whatever, if we have survival capacity, reproductive capacity, power over other beings, articulation, command and authority, and awareness of infinite universe, all of those six count for nothing unless there is compassion for all beings that we encounter. And let's consider that problem. Take it seriously. Consider it really is a problem, and then decide whether or not you will work on it. If you don't decide to work, you won't. If you do decide to work, you won't. But there is a difference. You make an effort in the one case, and the effort gets a reward that the lack of decision does not get. The moment you try to be compassionate, you will create situations inside yourself. Now this is tremendously important. It is said that the word fire and the word pure have the same origin, which is true. Now fire purifies. That is to say, the fire gets rid of every non-essential. Now how do we generate fire inside our own being? The answer is by opposing tendencies within us. If we don't oppose, we can't create the opposition, the friction that generates the heat that throws out the rubbish. In order to become more and more essential, and therefore more intelligent, more powerful, we have to oppose our own inclinations on the inside, simply because they are inclinations. Inclinations are inertias, and inertias are not free spirit. So in order to become a free, intelligent, self-initiating power, at our stage of evolution, we have to practice self-opposition. We look for any tendency, whether it's so-called good or bad, it doesn't matter, any tendency. First we have to stop it, and in the opposing of the inclination, forces are going in opposite directions and raising the temperature and purifying the being. They are throwing out non-essentials. Let's think of the ultimately pure being as a being with no non-essentials. Now the essential, as Heraclitus pointed out, is itself fire. That is to say, to purify is to return ourselves into the condition of fire before creation, before polarization. Now the essence of that fire is that it is itself sentient power in its initiative phase. No inertia. How do you like the idea of having the capacity for self-initiation anywhere, so you determine your own condition, your own destiny, entirely by the will and intelligence inside you, freely operative, not pushed by inertia? Does it sound nice? Well, there is a way of getting it, and only one way. And that way is self-contradiction. And the reason is you want to force going along, and you want to force going in the opposite direction. Now the inclination provides you with one force. That inclination led to the fall. The fall led to the generation of opposition, of obstacles, of gross materiality, of inertia. And the fight against inertia is to fight back to free initiative. There is no other way to get it other than self-opposition. It's no good buffing oneself up by remembering the high things you thought about. In the Russian prayer of Jesus, there's a lovely statement: when engaged in prayer, one prays in the heart. One is not to allow oneself to be diverted by high thoughts. Thinking is not the same as compassion. And only compassion, universal compassion, attends to everything. Try that during the interval, will you? Actually try, the person you talk to, or whatever it is, actually try to think that person is myself inside that body, where the self, capital S, is the infinite power, the infinite sentient power. And it's there, sitting in my friend Peter there, who's been singularly quiet for some reason. And sitting in Bill behind him. All the people I look at, they're all gods sitting there. If I forget it, then I can go down below and start surviving and reproducing and exercising power, skipping the compassion, talking, commanding, and transcending. But if I do that using only 6 instead of 7, I shall fall apart. And therefore the number 6, which means existent, also means fundamental evil. That is to say, disintegration of the being through non-attendance to the one thing that makes it cohere, namely compassion. Shall we think about that?